Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Osprey Oriel Lake, founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, WECAN, International. She serves on executive committee for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, and she's the author of the award-winning book, Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Today, I would like to talk to you, among your many, many projects, I would love to talk with you specifically about Women for Forests. Can you talk about what it is, why it is, everything about it that you want to say?
Sure. Thank you so much. And I also wanted to begin by mentioning that I'm on Coastal Miwok territories, occupied Coastal Miwok territories in Northern California. And I just, you know, like a lot of folks, like to begin with a land acknowledgement because I just feel that it's important to express our gratitude, which is really important. But also, I think it's important to this conversation because it's a beginning. There's so much more that needs to be done, but it's a beginning towards undoing colonization and decolonizing and really addressing indigenous erasure, which I think is key to this topic of forests itself. And to just recognize that colonization is not over and the attacks against indigenous peoples and the assaults on their stolen lands is ongoing. So I just think it's an important part of the conversation. So just wanted to honor the Coast Miwok and the fact that I am on their territories. The areas of forests that the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network are working on are three different regions. We are working in the Amazon, specifically in Ecuador and Brazil. And then the second area we work in is in the Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically on the Itombe Rainforest, which is in eastern Congo. And then thirdly, the Tongass Rainforest in Alaska. And maybe I'll just say a little bit about these forests and the women that we're working with and why we selected those regions. I think right now, as probably a lot of your listeners are well aware, we are in a series of multiple crises. And I think you would really not be awake to this moment to not realize that humanity is really facing an existential crisis, whether we're talking about the climate, environmental degradation, certainly these pandemics, the pandemic that is going on right now with COVID-19 is bringing us to, you know, a moment in time that is quite epic as we reflect upon our existence and also our impact on the natural world and on the natural systems. And this goes from the forest, but also all the biodiversity, all the plants, all the animals that we rely on to live and that are part of Mother Earth's incredible, beautiful history. And I know I find myself, I want to talk about some of the technical details around the forest work that we do because I am a firm believer in getting on the ground and getting engaged both with our bodies on the line, our strategic analysis, as well as advocacy, but primarily for supporting indigenous peoples who are really the best custodians of their lands, as many United Nations studies and studies around the world show that the primary way to protect forests is through the indigenous peoples who have been the custodians of their traditional lands for a very long time, from time immemorial. But I want to go into those details, but I also want to say that I think it's important to also reflect very personally at this time as well. So many of the conversations that I usually engage in with financial institutions or governments, from the United Nations to local governments to statewide governments on these issues, are usually exempt from the human fact of what we are experiencing, what nature is experiencing. And I know from your incredible work that, there is room for a much fuller conversation where we can bring our full selves to the conversation. And I think that's really important because we are facing, such a dire moment around the world with our environmental situation, as well as here in the United States with this atrocious government that we're now dealing with the Trump administration, that I think we also need to express our feelings, express our passion, and express the many layers that we're being impacted. And for me, that also involves really lifting up Indigenous voices and all of the folks who are on the front line of a lot of these fights. So, in terms of, I think I'll just start with what's happening right now in Ecuador and Brazil, where, you know, we're seeing the dual crises of climate as well as COVID-19. And that's really important because particularly in Ecuador, a lot of the deforestation is due to the fact of mining, whether that's through fossil fuels or minerals. There's a lot of mining going in the regions that we work with. And then in Brazil, there's a lot of issues concerning different types of agribusiness from soy and cattle. And they're both facing different situations with their governments. Particularly lately, we've been focusing a lot on Brazil. We have brought Indigenous leaders to speak at the United Nations. They have a very difficult regime with the Bolsonaro administration that is basically attacking Indigenous people. And as I said earlier, you know, one of the key ways that we can protect forests around the world is through Indigenous leadership and the defenders of the land, the first defenders of the land. So it's very serious when we see in Ecuador and Brazil and across the Amazon, which is in different countries in South America, where defenders of the land are being attacked, whether they're being criminalized, threatened, or murdered. And we know from Global Witness that the rise of the killings of land defenders continues to grow. And this is very concerning for us, and we are working on some legal measures around that right now. Probably most of you listeners know that, you know, the Amazon, it has been called the lungs of the earth, and we really can't afford for this particular ecosystem to collapse. It is on the brink of collapse due to fires that have been happening. Some of those fires are due to rising global temperatures, but we saw many cases in Brazil last year that people, farmers and people who are doing agribusiness and making money from soy and cattle were lighting fires on their own with impunity and the administration just looking the other way. And this is hurting Indigenous peoples, destroying the Brazilian Amazon, and is a very a serious situation. And we're looking at heading into fire season again. So we're gearing up for supporting Indigenous people and their campaigns on that right now. And then I'll just move to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we're working in the Itombwe rainforest. The conditions there are very unwieldy. Some folks might know that in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, there's a lot of destabilization in terms of the government, all kinds of violence and challenges in the military. Anyway, it's a difficult situation to work to do forest conservation. The project we're working on is to protect this incredible Itombwe rainforest region to protect the old growth there. And we started working there about 5 years ago now. And we work with pygmy Indigenous women to do two things. One, to protect the old growth forest. It's really important for a lot of the Indigenous people to have other forest resources because they have been removed from their traditional ways of life. So we are created a band of you know, volunteers who basically monitor the old growth forest. So there's no longer illegal deforestation happening. But at the same time, we've been growing trees there for about 5 years now and reforesting damaged forest land. And that's been really exciting. And it gives the women income. It provides food and shelter and medicines for, you know, about 14 different communities now. And basically about 30% of the trees we're growing are for human use, and 70% are going back to rewild damaged lands. So it's a really wonderful model of, you know, lifting up women's leadership and bringing them stature in their communities and, you know, mitigating climate change and also creating agroecology practices for them. And then lastly, I'll talk about the Tongass rainforest in Alaska,
I'm sorry to ask such an ignorant question, but with the way the maps always work, how big is the DRC? It's always sort of strange because Africa ends up smaller on the way the maps are projected. How big is the DRC and how big is that particular rainforest?
I would give it the measure of maybe in terms of another, let's say like the size of California. That might be a good way for people just to picture it, like the size of California.
Is the DRC? Does that rain? Does that particular rainforest cover most of it? Is it a tiny little rainforest? Can you give us like a 30-second or 1-minute introduction? Because we've all heard of the Amazon, but I think a lot of us have not heard of that. Can you tell us a little bit more? Who lives there? There's the pygmies live there, the pygmy women and men. And then do elephants live there? What? Tell us a little bit more if you don't mind.
Sure. The Congo Basin, okay, so the four main forests in the world that I think need protection, I think this might put it into context, are the Indonesian forests, the boreal forests, which were up in Canada and up in Alaska, the Congo Basin, which is more than just in the DRC. It's larger and in other countries. And the Amazon rainforest, which again covers like 9 countries. So those are the four main big forests when we're talking about, you know, forest conservation. And the Congo Basin is second to the size of the Amazon rainforest. I don't have an exact figure in front of me. I'd have to look it up myself. But in terms of the second largest rainforest in the world, that is the Congo Basin. And it suffers from deforestation, mining, and, you know, resource extraction. And so that's the threats that it's facing right now. But it's, I know, as you say, most people do hear about the Amazon rainforest, but the Congo Basin is second to the Amazon in terms of importance and size. So I think that maybe gives a little context. And then in terms of biodiversity, it is also, the Amazon rainforest is the most biodiverse region in the world, meaning, you know, in terms of plants and animals and diversity. But the Congo Basin also is quite high, not as high as the Amazon, but, you know, probably second or third in the world in terms of biodiversity and plant and animal life of unique species. So maybe that puts a little bit into context. Thank you for the question. I think it's a really good point that you bring up. Like, why do we not know more about the Congo Basin? And, why don't we know more about the Indonesian forests? You know, I feel that a lot of times, myself included, here in the United States, we can be very, in looking and not really understanding what's happening in the rest of the world. And yet a lot of our economic practices, a lot of our economic extraction, a lot of the things that we use on a daily basis, you know, from our computers and everything else are, you know, being mined from a lot of these areas that are out of sight and out of mind. And we really can't afford to do that right now. So I really appreciate the question because I didn't know anything about the DRC either until I got involved with tree planting there. But just to say that the Congo Basin is equally important to save, if you will, as the Amazon. And then lastly, I was just going to bring up the point about the Tongass rainforest in Alaska, which is, again, when I talk to people about the Tongass, they've never heard of it. It's the largest national forest in the United States. It's a temperate, it's not a rainforest, but it's a temperate rainforest. And it sequesters about 8 to 10% of all of our carbon emissions in the United States through forests. So it has also been sort of coined as the climate forest of the US. So it's a pretty important forest to all of us. It's the home of the Tlingit and Haida peoples. It's their traditional territories. And right now it's under a lot of threat because the Trump administration has been trying to roll back something called the Roadless Rule, which came out in 2001, that not only applied to the Tongass, but to other areas across the United States. And in essence, it said no more roads can be built in these areas as a way of conservation of wild lands. And in this case, in the Tongass, to protect old growth forests. And along with thousands of other things that we could say about the Trump administration, one of the things they're trying to do is roll back the 2000 roadless rule so that they can get into the Tongass and cut down do more industrial scale logging of old growth forests in the Tongass, as well as bring in mining. And not only would this be a disaster for the indigenous peoples who, this is the case all over the world, you know, their lifeways are deeply intertwined, interlocked with the ecosystem itself. So not only would it harm them in terms of their lifeways and their subsistence lifestyle of fishing and hunting and gathering, it will also be very destructive for all Alaskans because, you know, people live off of the fishing industry and all of the things that nature there has to provide, and not to mention be a disaster for carbon emissions here in the United States since it holds, as I said, 8 to 10% of our carbon emissions in the atmosphere. So we're in a big fight right now. I was just speaking to you earlier about the campaign we're on. We're getting ready to actually go on a delegation to virtually in this case to Washington DC next week with a group of Tlingit and Yupik indigenous women from the Tongass to go talk to legislatures about the roadless rule. This is about the third delegation we have generated to bring indigenous women to speak for themselves to lawmakers about protecting their traditional lands. And again, just to voice again that it's so key to have the role of indigenous peoples included in these conversations first and foremost, because I think, you know, whether it's the Amazon, the Congo Basin, or here in the Tongass Rainforest, we are primarily focused on ensuring that indigenous peoples, particularly indigenous women, have space to go directly talk to people making decisions about their territories and to explain the ecosystem, explain their ways of life, and explain also their management of these systems and how they have maintained them since time immemorial in a good and healthy way. And so we think this is one of the key strategies that we need to implement amongst others, but it's really important. So we're getting ready for that now. I feel like I've gone on for a while, and I think I'll just pause there and hand the floor back to you.
Oh, no, thank you for all that. Thank you so much for saying everything you've just said. My next question is, why women?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And that could be a day long conversation for sure, if not longer. But I'll start with sort of a wider comment and then specifically around forests. I started the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, the seeds of it in 2009. And it was right after the collapse of the Copenhagen negotiations, when all the governments met every year as they do at the UN climate talks. And Obama had just come into office, and a lot of us thought, great, you know, we're going to have this new administration, they're going to have the climate talks, and we're going to start resolving this crisis. And that did not work out. And I stopped pretty much doing everything what I was doing before and started researching, you know, where would be a powerful node of action? What would really be a place where there could be impact? And I found through a lot of research and other people's research as well that one of the untold stories of the climate crisis and environmental degradation is not only are women impacted first and worst due to gender inequality worldwide, but they're also key to solutions. And a lot of that has to do with their the fact that they're backbone a lot of the movements. When women are in charge of decision-making for their communities, a lot of those decisions have sort of the seventh generation, if you will, concept in mind and manage things well. We can look right now at the COVID-19 crisis. We can see that countries led by women have done far better in managing the crisis than countries led by men. And You know, when we look at food security, when we look at water issues, many United Nations studies show when women are in charge of these programs, they work. And when you don't have women involved with them, the food security goes down. Water is not conserved. So there's a myriad of ways. And like I said, it's a big topic, but women are actually key to this moment and their solutions and what they've been doing for years that has gone unrecognized and untold. Specifically dealing with forests, you know, women defending and protecting trees has a super long history. And, you know, one prominent example people might be familiar with is the women of the Chipko movement in India. It's based on the Gandhian movement that was founded on nonviolent principles of Satyagraha. And, you know, it's the story of how the women, the Chipko women, basically fostered a rural women's movement in 1970s in a Himalayan region of India. And they surrounded the trees because they did not want them to be cut by the government and commercial logging, which would escalate deforestation in the area. And Chipko actually means to hug. And they were, you know, the first tree huggers. And they hugged the trees. They literally stood in front of the trees and would not let the logging operation continue. I think one of the things is that, you know, women in communities who are living from the land, particularly indigenous women, local women, you know, realize that logging is destroying their forests, which they're dependent upon for their food, for their medicines, for their pharmacy. I mean, it's everything. They are so intertwined with the forest that they are willing, you know, to put their bodies on the line. So I think it has a long history of the fact, again, of women being the ones who are collecting the food and managing the families and managing the home economics, if you will. And they have been leaders in this movement for quite some time. I think just I would also mention just as another image that's not directly related to, you know, why women are leading the way, but I think it's also just interesting in the sense of the feminine principle, which is people are becoming more familiar with something that indigenous knowledge keepers have known for a long time and modern scientists are now catching up with, which is this idea of the mother trees. And we know that trees in the forest are connected by an underground network that spans for miles with the oldest trees, the old growth, acting as guardians, if you will, to the younger trees. And scientists are finally catching up with indigenous knowledge about how these networks are kept by these mother trees and how they feed the younger trees around them and warn them about attacks from insects and provide them from nutrients. And they look out for their neighbors and these living systems from these mother trees really showed us how much forests really rely on cooperation. And I think it's a great, not just metaphor, but symbol and fact for us to look at is the need for these old growth trees, these mother trees to guide the younger trees and to care for the forest overall. So I think they're really vital, but women have been, you know, at the forefront of a lot of these fights, to protect forests for a long time. And one of the things that I think is really important, as I was sort of mentioning before, is I think it's really key to recognize that now more than ever, we must defend the defenders of the land. Global Witness, the organization Global Witness, has again been saying year after year, like in, you know, 2019, again, we've seen an increase in environmental land defenders, a lot of them indigenous. I know from, you know, my friends and colleagues like Sonia Guajajara, who's one of the most powerful women indigenous leaders I know in Brazil, you know, how many threats she's facing constantly against her life for standing up to protect the Amazon rainforest. It's one of the deadliest countries in the world. The Philippines also is a very deadly country for land defenders. And, you know, the agribusiness and oil and gas and mining sectors have been consistently the biggest drivers of attacks against land and environmental defenders, as an example, in Brazil. So there's a collusion between the government and corporations to go after those speaking out to protect the forests. And that's a very big concern of ours. And something that women face, not only as all land defenders, but there's also the fact of sexual attacks and attacks in their families that have like a unique perspective for women land defenders. It is also a very big concern of ours. The other thing I wanted to mention, you know, and then again, I want to hand the floor back to you for more questions, because speaking of Ecuador, I mean, because this is all kind of grim things that I'm discussing, because so much of, you know, so much of our force are under attack, and we must save them, and through exploitation, you know, we're seeing that, you know, this is not decreasing right now, it's increasing. And we need to mention that, you know, reforestation is really essential, but there is nothing that can substitute old growth forests. And we really need to continue to do all that we can to protect them. And one of the things that has excited me a great deal is that we work with some wonderful women, women land defenders, forest defenders in Ecuador, Quechua women from Sariaco. And one of the things that their community has done for several decades, but has become more visible in the last, let's say 10 years more publicly, is, again, with this idea that there are all these different stories, studies rather, and institutions that have determined that the most effective way to protect forests and biodiversity and thus, you know, help mitigate climate catastrophe is by supporting indigenous peoples, their rights, their lands, their traditional ecological knowledge. This is key, and yet there's no international designation for conservation currently existing that that really recognizes the unique relationship between indigenous peoples and the forest. It's sort of understood that they're important, but like, what is that unique relationship? And one thing that I love about what the Sariaco people did is they created something called the Living Forest Declaration, Causaxacha, it's called. And it represents many, many years of work and advocacy and proposes the protection of the Quechua way of life, including emphasis on uncontaminated rivers, that their communities are recognized in a sovereign way, and a mandate that their territories in Ecuador be permanently free of any type of extractive activity from oil exploitation, mining, logging, etc. And the declaration contends that Sariaco's territory is subject to legal rights and demand that these rights are upheld. And some folks might know that in Ecuador, in particular in 2008, they brought rights of nature into their constitution to recognize and thereby award legal rights to nature. So this Living Forest Declaration fits right into an alignment with the Ecuadorian constitution. And it embodies really countless generations of ancestral knowledge. And I'll just share one piece because it's so lovely and beautiful and helps us to have like a different worldview about how to view nature and where people are living. It's called the Jatun Causak Sisa Napi, or in English, and I'm sure I pronounced that terribly, my apologies. It's called the Living Way of Flowers Project, and that's underway right now. And with this project, the Sariaco are planting native flowering trees and plant species along the boundary of their about 333,000-acre territory to symbolically and geographically demarcate their lands and to convey the beauty and really the delicate nature of life and the fertility of the living forest. So, you know, instead of putting up a fence or guardrails or, you know, having military posts, they're demarcating their lands with flowers. And I don't know, when I first heard that, I just started to cry. I just thought that was so beautiful. Like, this is how we're showing where we live, is by showing the beauty of the land. So this is what they're working for, and it's there's not time to go into it, but it's a very complex declaration showing how to care for the forest. People can find it online. It's called the Living Forest Declaration by the Sariaco people, demonstrating, you know, how you can protect a forest and how they have lived there for, you know, time immemorial to protect the Amazon rainforest. And I think we need to really look at this kind of indigenous knowledge and this multifaceted vision that needs to be respected by governments, and that we need to actually go back to indigenous people for conservation technology and for conservation plans that are out of Western views of extractive economies and the way that we use forests.
So thank you. Thank you for all of that. And that would be a wonderful note to jump forward on, but I'm going to jump back for a second. Because you said something a while ago that I wanted to ask you more about, which is, you didn't say this, but you said something pretty close to women bearing the brunt of climate change. And you said it much better than that. But you've also, on the WeCan website, it says that given dominant gender-ascribed responsibility for meeting household food, water, medicine, and energy needs, forest degradation sharply increases burdens on women and girls. And, you know, we hear quite often that women will bear the brunt of ecological degradation. And we do know, I'm just going to set this aside, we do know that ecological degradation and social dislocation often lead to more violence against women. Can you talk either about that or about, or both, or about tangibly, how does ecological degradation make women's lives harder? Because we always hear it and nobody ever talks specifics.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. So specifically, what happens is, as an example, when, you know, there was a couple of studies that showed that when a giant flood happens, okay, let's say there's a tsunami or something of that nature, or flooding in a region, due to gender inequality in some countries, you know, some Middle Eastern countries, as an example, because of gender norms where women are, you know, in essence, by law, ordered to stay in the home or not allowed to drive a car or allowed to learn how to swim. You can imagine in a catastrophe that, you know, is a flood or a tsunami, those women that are at a terrific disadvantage because they can't drive, they can't swim, and they're locked in their homes. So, like, that's just a really practical example of an impact. Also, we know that during, you know, different catastrophes where, again, you know, women are displaced, they often face sexual violence because they're now in a situation where, you know, they're not protected, they're out on the street, they're migrating, you know, forced through, you know, being you know, moved from their homes due to whatever disaster might have happened, whether it's a fire or a flood from a climate impact. And now they're exposed and unprotected. So there's also a component of just their bodies being under, you know, threat from a natural disaster of some sort. In terms of the sort of day-to-day impact, again, due to the types of gender norms that we have, where most women are expected to care for their children and feed them, care for the elders in their homes, provide the food, provide the provide all the medical needs. Anytime there is, you know, an economic issue or environmental degradation issue, and any of those resources are diminished, then women are on the front lines of trying to figure out, you know, how are they going to feed their families? How are they going to get medicines for their elders? And often what happens to women is, you know, you'll hear how, you know, in different emergency situations, they will stop feeding themselves so that they can feed their children and their grandparents or their parents. And so, you know, just at some of the basic survival level, this is what happens to women. In other aspects, in terms of even women who, let's say, are attempting to have organizations to, to help in some way, whether that's around health issues or environmental issues. You know, the funding for women to operate their organizations is much, much lower. You know, there's not a lot of funding that goes into environmental and social issues in the first place when you look at overall philanthropy. But when you break it down, the percentage that actually goes to women-led organizations so that they can do the work that they need to do, again, there is a huge gap, and that funding is quite low, again, due to patriarchal, you know, institutionalized patriarchy and you know, the general view of women not being leaders or not being worth being paid the same amount of money. Those norms exist globally. So these impacts are something that women face and make their work that much harder. A lot of the women who are on the front lines, again, as I was mentioning earlier, who you know, maybe are on the front lines of standing up for forests or standing up to fossil fuel companies, who are involved in direct actions, face sexual abuse for those activities. You know, without naming names, I've had colleagues who have been raped for their standing on the front lines and standing up to fossil fuel companies. So there is a gender dimension to these activities that women definitely face.
And thank you for all of that. And I'm thinking of another one, which on one level sounds trivial, but I mean, compared to a lot of that, but is also day to day pretty horrifying, is I've read about in many places, women are primarily responsible for providing the water. And if water sources dry up, that means instead of walking a quarter mile a day carrying water, you now have to walk 5 miles a day carrying water.
Exactly, exactly. And that's a very, very, very big issue. And thank you for highlighting that. There are places, you know, and it, as droughts increase, of course, women have to walk further and further and further to get water. So you're quite right in that. I mean, there's been a lot of studies showing how women, girls in this case, you know, younger women, you know, forfeit going to school and getting educated because they're spending most of their day, literally most of their day, walking to get water. That is what their daily activity is. And so they are unable to go to school and unable to get educated. And actually, in the case of the project that we have in the Democratic Republic of Congo, one of the things that we were, it's not exactly around water, but it brings up the same sort of topic, which is, due to deforestation and the need every day for the women to collect firewood to cook with, which we're also working on cook stoves so that they don't need to do this. But in the meanwhile, the fact is that they are going into the forest to go collect firewood so that they can cook meals every day. They were having to walk further and further and further. And the further they walked, the higher cases of sexual violence occurred. So vis-a-vis planting all these trees and reforesting around their local communities, the women are walking, you know, directly near their homes, and the safety level has gone up considerably and the sexual violence gone down considerably because they're not vulnerable walking alone in the forests. So, you know, it's just another example, but your water examples, very, very important, especially because droughts are increasing.
So can you talk a little bit more about the tree planting in the DRC?
Sure. You know, it's a real grassroots organization. I should say, you know, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, we're super small. We're really, really small. So, we work, you know, on a really small budget, and everything is very collectively done, and with a lot of volunteer effort and you know, done at a very simple level. And in some ways, what's good about that is we're not top heavy, and we've been able to move through this COVID and climate crisis quite well because we're not dependent on a lot of infrastructure. So that's also the case with the tree planting in the DRC. Basically, we did and continue to do a series of online trainings, extensive trainings with a lot of the women who do the tree planting. in a wide variety of trainings that have to do with everything from climate change to women's empowerment. It should be noted, again, since we're on the topic of women, which is that in the DRC, which is a very, you know, as all governments are quite misogynistic, but it's a country that is one of the most violent places in all of the world for women in terms of the violence that, that women experience. And not only are they women in a violent country, but they're indigenous women. So they're way at the bottom, if you will, unfortunately, of the rung. And so, you know, a lot of the trainings at first were a lot about women's empowerment and dignity. And I think one of the things that moved me the most about this program is not only mitigating climate change, reforesting this forest, which was the primary thing, giving these women jobs, was just the incredible emotional beauty of seeing these women find respect, find dignity and purpose and their import. Because as we've gone through all these trainings and they have been planting trees for 5 years now, you know, they've had international press. We've brought some of the women to the UN climate talks to tell their stories. They now see themselves as not only contributing to their communities, being people who are bringing, you know, resources into their home and their community, but also having an international voice and contributing to mitigating a world problem like climate change. And that has been really, really thrilling. So the basic way it works is that there's all these trainings on forests and tree care and climate change and women's empowerment. And after a series of trainings, the women set up very, very simple nurseries, close to waterways and close to where, you know, we're going to be reforesting next so that they're not transporting long distances because there are no vehicles. All of this is being done by hand. So, we set up the nurseries, very, very simple nurseries. The women grow the trees. Again, everything's done by hand. So they're, you know, taking their buckets and going to the river and one by one planting the trees, the tree saplings. And then the planting of the trees happens during the rainy season. And the women, you know, again, all done by hand. Put the saplings into baskets, put them on top of their heads. We're used to sort of seeing that image coming out of different countries of Africa very beautifully, you know, going off into to the areas they're going to reforest with a bucket of saplings on their heads and plant the trees and then tend to them very carefully until the trees are rooted enough to get their own tap roots and water themselves. And so, yeah, that's kind of the operation. And then, like I said, 30% of the trees specifically are intended for human use so that they no longer go to the old growth forest, which is what we're trying to protect. And they use that for sheltering their homes, medicinal trees, food, and all other manner of things that they need for their cooking, for their food, for their fires. Their fire for their food making and then 70% of the trees are untouched to just rewild the land.
And how long have you been doing that project?
It's been about 5 years now. It's been 5 years.
So what's the status of the biggest, what's the status of the oldest one of those? So what it's, the trees are now 20 feet tall?
Good guess. Very good guess. That's exactly right. We were just on a call, a Zoom call the other day, and one of the tallest trees is about 20 feet tall. And we were very lucky because at the end of last year, there was an uprising in the region. There's a lot of different uprisings that go on. I can't explain all the politics of the region because it's very complex. But there was a big uprising and rebels came into the area where we were. The villages that we work with were all burnt to the ground. And we're just getting everybody reestablished right now. And we're about to start our next round of nurseries. So everybody sort of resettled. There were, unfortunately, some killings. And like I said, the villages burnt to the ground, but we're reestablishing everything, but the report came back that none of the trees were harmed. None of the trees were burnt. All the trees are there. So all the women were super, super happy about that. And, so we're going to continue on. I have to say these women are incredibly powerful and courageous. And, the other thing I love about them is they don't do anything without singing. Everything is with song. When they plant the trees, they sing. When they harvest, they sing. Everything is through song. And they've taught me a lot about how to ennoble our very everyday tasks and just to be in love with maintenance, if you will, and the cycles of everyday life.
So we have just a few minutes left, and I have a trivial question and then a question of how people can support you. And the trivial question is, or these efforts, the trivial question is, how much of a problem is the fact that all these women all over the world speak different languages? What made me think of it is you said they're singing, which is sort of a universal language. But everybody speaks different languages. So how much does that slow your communication?
It's a great question. In each place we work, it's different. But, we do translate. There's like when we do, we're very fortunate, an example in the DRC, Nima Namandu, who is our main coordinator leader, she's an amazing force of nature herself, fortunately speaks English as well as the local dialect. And so, the calls are quite long as we translate back and forth through Nima. And then with the women in Brazil who speak Portuguese and the women in Ecuador who speak Spanish and, of course, their own local dialect, it's all done through translation. So, it's all, key to have translation and going through a laborious process of that when we call. And then, very grassrootsy. There is Google Translate. And so, when we text or email back and forth, you can always use Google Translate and get the basic concepts through. So, that's what we do.
One more question before we go to how people can support the work, which is I've interviewed a few people who have been working in, very dangerous circumstances and, I'm wondering that sounds terrifying, that there was a revolt came through and killed local people. And how does your organization navigate between what could be oppressive governments and what could be oppressive resistance movements? I don't know where to take that wherever you want. It seems like just very, very difficult and scary.
It is. I tell you, there are a lot of nights that I'm up all night worrying on these issues, worrying for the women that we work with. I can't even begin to tell you, like when we first started doing some of the trainings on the ground in the DRC, the military showed up and I was terrified for the women, which way this was going to go. And we were very fortunate. It turned out the military and the DRC were so thrilled with what they were doing, they asked to be a part of the training. So we had a women's training with a bunch of military guys. And it ended up being that in the long run, they ended up supporting us and protecting us because they thought what we were doing was really wonderful. So that was one outcome. The women in Brazil and Ecuador right now, I'm always afraid for them. I'm checking in with them on a regular basis. We do campaigning around them. We are in touch with Urgent Action Fund and some of these other organizations that their primary focus is, working with women in emergency crisis situations. We've certainly sent funds to move women from one location to another in an immediate threat situation. And we try to monitor that. Global Witness is a great organization, Urgent Action Fund. There's a few others. I'm not thinking of them right now that, their expertise is this. And of course we work to coordinate with them. And the other thing that we're working on right now, and I'll leave it at this because I'm very excited about this, which is there's something called the Escazú Agreement, which is out of the United Nations. And we don't have the time to go into it in detail, but in essence, we're working to help advocate for that. It's specific to Latin America. And what it would do, it will beef up the kinds of legal protections for land defenders. And we're working very, very hard this year and next year to pass that agreement throughout Latin America, which will give us a very powerful legal foothold to be able to stand up for the rights of land defenders and have there be real consequences if governments or corporations step over that line. So I think there's some advocacy components that are very key now so we can defend the defenders of the land, but it is a situation that we deal with on a daily basis.
Well, thank you for all that. And the last question is, so first off, I just want to mention your website, wecaninternational.org, wecaninternational.org. And so how can people support your work and the work of these women all over the world? And if somebody wants to, do more than donate, what can they do too?
Yeah, I mean, donations, of course, is the number one thing because you need funds to do this. And that's, you know, how you can do it on our website. But I would encourage people to sign up for our newsletter, because then you can find out what's going on with what we're doing with Women for Forest, but some of our other programs and campaigns. And we also do webinars. We're about to do a webinar actually on August 27th this month that happens to be on Women for Forest. And people can go to our website and learn about that, where you can directly hear from the women themselves. The different women I've been talking about in these regions are all going to be reporting back on what's happening in their communities. So it's more like an educational way people can get involved, but I think it's going to be really exciting. And that's August 27th. And then I think the last thing I'll say is, you know, wherever you are, find out what's happening in your area with your forests, because again, as we talked earlier in the program, you know, what are some of the key nodes that we need to deal with right now? To me, are forests and biodiversity protection to survive this time. The rights of indigenous peoples and supporting indigenous movements is essential. I don't have time to explain all of that why, but we talked about that some. And then also stopping the fossil fuel industry, which is a big part of our work, is divestment campaigns with banks and financial institutions to stop the fossil fuel industry. So I think these are ways that we have to look at, you know, where can we stop a lot of bad stuff from happening and protect life and protect the web of life.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Osprey Oriel Lake. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.